Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ecom Gold Podcast. As always, I appreciate you tuning in and listening. Today, we have a fantastic guest, Fraser Kinsley, who is pretty well known on Twitter for his VC company with his brother. They invest in early stage e-commerce, mainly D2C and mainly beverage and food goods. And he also has created this incredible piece of technology, a SaaS platform, but much, much more for the smaller brands of this world to be able to leverage and utilize some of the cost efficiencies and optimizations available to some of the bigger brands when it comes to logistics. And he explains why so many brands are unable to traditionally leverage that. He looks at what is coming up in the future of D2C e-commerce and how people can get in front of more customers more effectively and ultimately drive more profits for their brands. He talks about what he's looking for from new companies that are looking to raise capital and how that climate's changed. He also goes into depth about the Shopify Flexport Amazon thing and helps explain that to me because I wasn't 100% sure what was going on there, but he put it perfectly. This is a great episode. I really hope you enjoy it. As always, this show is brought to you by Rewind, the app that takes a backup of your store, your products, your customers, basically your data. Should you ever need it, if there's a mistake made, something's deleted, you can just hit a button, it's restored for you. Shopify does not do that for you. It is an imperative application, in my opinion. It also gives you a staging site to be able to make all your changes rather than making them on your live site and then messing something up and costing yourself a lot of money. Go and check it out. Links in the show notes below, or go to Rewind's website and SendLane. Email, SMS, and reviews. Reviews are free, by the way, with SendLane. The storm in the industry that is taking Klaviyo's market share, and quite rightly so, an incredible team, a modern platform, a modern product, and they are killing it. So go and check out SendLane if you haven't already and grab a demo with them. Links again below, or just Google SendLane. Over to you, Fraser. Give us an introduction to yourself. Fraser, welcome to the E-commerce Gold Podcast. It's great to have you here. How are you doing today?
Not too bad. How you been?
Yeah, very good. Where are you calling in from today?
I'm in New York currently.
Uh-huh. Whereabouts?
Out on Long Island. I live in the city, just bounce back and forth between a scene family on the island and beat in Manhattan.
I've got a friend in Long Island. I don't know how small or big Long Island is. I imagine it's one of those places where I'm like, hey, do you know this guy? And it's actually absolutely massive. But I've heard it's a nice place to live. So congratulations on
Thank you.
Tell everybody, if you will, who you are and what you do in this place.
Definitely. So I kind of a bit of a different background than probably most in the space. But I am, first and foremost, the co-founder and managing partner of Kinsley Partners, which is a seed stage, early stage investment firm for CPG brands. So we're investors and advisors to about a dozen CPG brands. This just started as like a dorm room fund, if you will, just between my brother and I investing our own capital. Again, in early stage CPG brands. And then on the side of that, my focus is actually really on the supply chain aspect of CPG. So I used to own and operate a third-party warehouse and logistics company called Hook Logistics. Had several warehouse locations throughout the U.S. Moved on from that in 2021. And since then, have been working with brands and third-party logistics companies really on their total supply chain, everything from factory sourcing to freight forwarding to domestic freight distribution. So a little less of a marketing background, more so on the operations and supply chain side, but been in the space for a while. I grew up kind of in it. My parents were very early on in the Swatch watch days, which seem to be coming back, albeit 35 years later. So it's been a part of my life for a while now.
Is that where you got the bug for D2C? Does it come through? Is it a family-based business?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things. I joke around that like we're a family of like merchants, and so I think that it was just a natural progression going into like the digital age. I just became obsessed with it. I was just like a product person. You know, back in 2018 when we started Kinsley Partners, we joked around, my brother and I, we're just gonna invest in stuff that we use, and so it just became a very natural fit for us. So I've always been into the industry, and it's just another way to kind of access it.
Swatch have done a great job, I think, recently. At least if you're counting a good job as in how relevant they are in terms of being seen. I see it almost every other day, I think, with that. Was it an Amigo collab? And then did some like limited edition drops. And I actually found myself in a mall in Asian part of the world, and I saw a Swatch shop, and I thought, I'm just going to ask. I'm not a big watch guy, and I was just like, I actually went in, and I was like, do you have any of these? Because I was just like, maybe I'll just pick one up. And I was like, what the hell? I kind of walked out of there. They didn't have them. But I walked out thinking, I've never done that before. And that was really interesting to me. I was like, wow, I have been sold. What was going on?
It's crazy. I mean, I think that back in the 80s and 90s, they were kind of a cult favorite, like the Swatch Scuba Watch. They had tons of different editions, and it kind of had this cult following. And I think it's very similar to what you're seeing now with the Omega collaboration and the Blancpain collaboration as well, where it's just these companies that have been around for a while that I think continue to be relevant, basically. I think is kind of its own, case study in marketing, right? So I think that, again, not that I'm coming from the marketing side, but, you know, I think to continue to be relevant there, with relevant collaborations, and also tuning into, I think, what the consumer is looking for these days, I think is significantly different than, again, it was in the 80s and 90s. And so, yeah, you know, kudos to them. I think they've kind of evolved. And I think there's a lot of brands like that, but I think Swatch is one that was a little bit surprising because they kind of fizzled out, in the mid 2000s, and then kind of came roaring back with these two collaborations. And yeah, I don't think you can find the Omega collaborations really anywhere. Never mind the Blancpain ones, but I think they're at a price point that makes sense to people. I do think they're quality, and I think people recognize the names that they're running those collabs with. So definitely super relevant.
So take us back to this time. You and your brother, you're college, dorm, you're a retired D1 athlete. I understand that means that you're pretty good enough someone to sort of want you in the college for your talents. What sport were you playing?
Yeah, so I played lacrosse in college. It was a pretty serious thing growing up. So on Long Island, it's a pretty big deal. I was playing from a really early age. And funny enough, my brother and I were able to go to college together. He played baseball. I played lacrosse. He's 2 years older than me. I got out of school, was working for a supply chain procurement company. And again, we just had this itch to just really get into the industry. And we really had no idea what we're doing. We were just like, yeah, we kind of want to invest. My brother took a more traditional finance route, so he knew a little bit. But we really just started cold emailing and, running cold outreach on LinkedIn to say, hey, if you're an early stage brand and you're looking for, growth capital, but also, we're probably your target audience. So again, going after food and beverage companies, men's grooming and skincare, stuff like that, I think really just kind of fit for what we were using already. And so we were like, hey, look, we're your target audience. We have a little bit of capital deployment. I mean, kind of it's just our own money. Is this a partnership that you're looking for? And I think it really struck a chord with a lot of the brands that we've worked with. I think, again, having my brother come from the traditional finance side, be able to offer help on the fundraising side, and then my experience in the operations side. So, I think we brought a little bit more than just a check, which was, I think, a good way in for us. I'm not sure if that would have worked, if we started doing this now in 2022 or 2023, but it definitely worked back in 2018. So I'm glad we caught it at the right time.
What was your end goal with that then? So you just wanted to, you obviously had a passion for it and you just wanted to be part of the scene, I guess. You wanted to be involved in the mud. But what was your kind of end game for that? What were you thinking at the time?
Yeah, it was really just a way to get access to the private market, really. I think for us, there was a lot of investment going on in the tech world, still is, although it's kind of fizzled out just a little bit since, again, the heyday of like 2017 to 2019. I think the end game for us was really just like a diversification play. We kind of saw it as an area that we kind of had, again, direct influence over if we're buying these products. It's kind of like the age old, piece of advice is, invest in the things that you use or the things that you buy, which again, on like the public scale is a little bit more, tougher to kind of influence. But if we're on the ground, if we're buying these things, if we're telling our friends and family about these things, we can potentially influence the purchasing patterns of these things, and thus drive just a better ROI for us on our investments. And then I think it was just a hobby, right? I think it's we both have an interest in, you know, consumer goods, what's new, what's out there. You know, so it's a bit of a passion project, as well as a way to, again, just diversify an investment portfolio.
And well, so I guess you've probably got a bottle of Huron knocking around then, because I believe you guys got involved with Matt. Fairly early on, a cool dude and a fellow sports person, I believe. So,
yes.
But in terms of that relationship, how did that end up playing out for you guys? Were you able to do the hands-on things you wanted to do? Like, did it, you know, what did it, just talk us through, okay, you did a deal. What did that look like for you and the brand in terms of day-to-day, week-to-week?
Yeah, so it depends on the brand that we're working with. Some, you know, we're kind of from afar. Others, you know, we're in the nitty-gritty every single day. Or I shouldn't say every single day, but, you know, several times a week. But, you know, I think ultimately the way it played out was really, again, starting out on the operation side. I think if you look at the operation aspects or the operational aspects of e-commerce now versus 4 or 5 years ago, it's a significantly different landscape. So again, this was kind of like, I was starting our 3PL at the same time. You know, this was before the ShipBobs of the world became super popular, the ShipMunks and all these other different kind of providers out there. And so from my standpoint, I'd seen really that brands who are moving into this digital age. And I think, again, there was that window of like 2018 to like 2020. And obviously during COVID, it exploded. There wasn't a lot of turnkey solutions for, you know, up and coming brands. And what I mean by turnkey is not just fulfillment of like, you know, pick, pack and ship, but, you know, advisory on, hey, what are supply chain best practices? You know, where can I actually look to source products and raw materials? How do I navigate freight forwarding? And so this idea of kind of bringing together supply chain for smaller brands coincided with, you know, investing in them with capital, but also with, you know, advisory. And so I think our play ultimately is, you know, if we can provide services alongside that investment, we can basically create an asymmetrical advantage for those brands at a very early stage in their business. And so, you know, a lot of our brands, and I don't want to say that, you know, to come across like, hey, we were providing this right off the bat. I think a lot of the brands we work with, you know, obviously have super talented operators as well. You know, again, Matt from here on, I think has done a fantastic job of growing the business organically and very helpfully. So, again, I think that we've kind of stood in the background, helped kind of where we can. I think it services the whole ecosystem that way.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And you've also got like another branch to your investment, haven't you? In that, that is a potential self-fulfilling prophecy, for another business. So that makes quite a lot of sense. And I do still think that there's quite a lot of confusion around some of the things you mentioned, like supply chain and freight forwarding and even finding raw goods. And I remember listening to a show where, I think it was on E-commerce Fuel, where he was talking about how they found the kind of most important ingredient and decided that to hold it in bulk because running out of it was costing them X and holding it in bulk would cost Y. But then, you know, the differentiation would work out better for the business. It's like all these minute things that you could spend just days looking at and working out. I think a lot of these kind of Shopify, not dropship, but the step up from that evolution, they've got a marketing brain, not a logistics and operations brain. I certainly don't. And I know there's a lot to it. So moving from your kind of investment portfolio, and is that still ongoing? Do you still make any seed investments, or are you calling off on that?
We do. We do. So it really, and it's kind of evolved over time. I think we've kind of focused again on health and wellness, mainly in food and beverage. We've kind of branched off into things like apparel, you know, other brands that have a SaaS component to them, other brands that have a brick and mortar component to them. So it's evolved in a way, but I think that we've kind of evolved with the market. And so I think the brands that we look at, it's basically, hey, how evergreen is this product? And what this, you know, what does this offering actually look like? I think we're a little bit counterculture to the rest of the industry in terms of, you know, again, I think, you know, things like community are important. But I think from our standpoint and what we've seen in the market, you know, things like community, you know, are not necessarily things you can put venture dollars behind. And the reason I say that is because, you know, I think now the bar has just been raised across the board. I think that's kind of table stakes, right? So, you know, it's almost expected that you have this community behind the product, and it's now, hey, how operationally efficient are you? You know, do you actually have good fundamentals behind this business? Because I think exactly to your point, a lot of brands out there, especially in the heyday, were mostly just marketing brands. And it was great. I mean, look, it's a viable business, but I think now the bar has just been raised significantly higher where everyone has to be a really good marketer. Everyone has to have a really good base for their community. But also, too, you have to have a great product. You have to have a great product market fit. Your sourcing capabilities have to be top notch. I just think the consumers started to expect more. And I think that directly coincides too with, you know, this idea of like the post iOS world where customer acquisition has gotten extremely expensive. And so the product that you're selling itself, actually has to have a true value prop and there has to be a true product market fit. So it's gotten to be a little bit different than it was again, for us at least, several years ago where we could have kind of, I don't want to say like, you know, stuck our finger up into the wind and say, all right, you know, what direction is this thing going in? But again, now it's more so what are the fundamentals and the bones of the business look like? And ultimately, you know, is this business able to generate venture returns? And I think that, again, for the longest time, that wasn't necessarily a question that was being asked. And I don't think it was incumbent upon the founders of these brands to do so. I think a lot of it was that the industry just wasn't looking at the right portions of businesses. And so, you know, you've now seen this big pivot from direct to consumer into things like retail, B2B wholesale, Amazon, where brands have become significantly more omnichannel. So there's a whole kind of slew of things that kind of come with that. But I think the brand itself, if you will, like the catch-all term brand idea has changed significantly in the past 4 or 5 years to become more of an omnichannel presence.
Do you have any fundamentals that you look at now when you see a deck? I guess what I'm trying to understand is what would impress you now? And has that changed since you started?
I think there's a way bigger focus on things like contribution margin. I think the idea behind, just gross margin, honestly. I mean, it's amazing. I think that 4 or 5 years ago, again, things like gross margin were definitely important, but not focused on as much. I think like CAG or TAM were very important. And these terms I'm throwing around are basically just, you know, financial metrics, you know, compound annual growth rate and, you know, total addressable market for just the size of the market and how fast the brand can grow. I think are becoming less important to things like contribution margin, which are essentially rolling up your variable costs, understand what your actual true margin is. The reason I say that is I think this is the same across any venture base, right? Whether it's technology or consumer goods, is ultimately how much money are you making on the services or products that you sell? And is this business a cash flowing business? And I think now that's becoming even more important for brands that are going into omnichannel to actually, again, understand things like what is your actual margin and what is your margin per channel? What is your margin per SKU? Which SKUs are profitable? Which channels are profitable? And then ultimately, you know, are you cash flowing this business? And the reason I say that is because for a lot of brands, it's great to get that Shopify payout fairly immediately. Whereas if you go into retail and the terms are, you know, net 90, can you afford to do that with the cash that you have on hand? So those are kind of the fundamentals that we're looking at are, obviously you have to have the cash on hand, but is this a cash flowing business? And do you have the margins to be able to support yourself when you go into retail and wholesale?
I imported a bulk import of products into Shopify and I did not put in the meta fields the created date. And that sent the whole filtering system haywire because you could no longer filter collections by newest in first or date added to the website, which was a really big problem for this quite large fashion brand. If I didn't have Rewind, that would have been a complete pickle. It would have taken hours, if not days, to sort out all of the while these products are live and really messing up their merchandising. A mistake by me, absolutely, but fortunately I had the foresight to install Rewind before I made any of these changes, and I was able to just click a button, restore the site back to a previous version just a few minutes before I made that fatal error, and no one was any the wiser. That's the value of Rewind. That's just one use case, okay? One use case. There are hundreds of other use cases. Have it on there because when you need it, you'll text me or you'll tweet me and say, thank you so much, Finn, for recommending that I install Rewind. You saved my bacon. Back to today's show.
I find that interesting that it's still a conversation that has to be had at that level when someone's pitching. Because in principle, you'd expect that to be table stakes nowadays. Now that the climate's changed and situations are changing, default alive, And I don't know when it was different. I'm not intelligent enough as an investor to understand when it's okay not to be default alive to grow a business and scale a business to kind of escape velocity where it doesn't matter anymore. But it does seem just good business fundamentals to be profitable, at least on, you know, your first purchase and be able to survive. I know there's other mechanics at play, but certainly that does seem. But how does that affect the kind of upside of the deal? Because you're then potentially looking at a slower growth business. But is that just more attractive now in a day like today?
Yeah. So I think to answer your first question about, you know, when did it kind of become important? I think part of the problem was that the industry was raising on not tech multiples, but like tech, not fundamentals, but like tech metrics, basically, where, you know, like growth at all costs. And I think for a physical goods business, it's really hard because with SaaS or any tech component, you know, to scale doesn't require incrementally more inputs, right? So like, take for instance, like Netflix. If they want to grow their fan base, yeah, there's, you know, some database, you know, construction that goes on, but ultimately to have one more user is not costing them incrementally more. Whereas to sell one more product is incrementally more expensive because you're paying for those products. And so I think that idea of growth at all costs that was applied to CPG brands specifically several years ago was kind of the frame of mind, whether people wanted to admit that or not. And so I think now where those things have changed and kind of evolved and why it's become more important is just because, you know, capital is more expensive. You know, when interest rates are super low and venture funds are just looking to basically place money somewhere to be able to deploy it, it's way easier to justify. And so I think part of the problem is, and I say this from the investor standpoint, is actually the investors in the industry. I think they're dictating a lot of, you know, what the metric should be, right or wrong. And so, you know, I think ultimately it's tough as a brand to raise in certain environments because, you know, you want to have certain fundamentals, but, you know, to your point, is my growth story now slowed down? Do I have to justify why maybe I'm not growing, you know, 2x quarter over quarter or month over month? And so I think part of it now is basically telling the story of like, yeah, I am a formidable business in my own right, albeit at a slower pace than maybe a tech company. But I have solid fundamentals here. And so I think the narrative behind that has changed a little bit. You know, I think ultimately the direction we're going in, is that of more traditional brands where, you know, maybe you have upstart investment or you're accessing lines of credit as opposed to, you know, raising multiple rounds, of investment. So we'll see what kind of happens. I think a lot of brands are getting back to, again, this idea of like fundamental growth. And again, I think that we live in a different age than, you know, hundreds of years ago, but it's the same merchant story, right? Like, do you have enough money to buy inventory to then sell? And, you know, what is your opportunity cost and things like that? Like, these things have been around since, you know, mercantilism started. So, you know, it's interesting to kind of see it come full circle.
What's your kind of sentiment on brands that did raise in the last 24 months that have either done their first round or maybe even a second round? How do you think they're feeling right now? And what do you think is the kind of short, long term for them, for their businesses? Do you think there's any way out?
I do. I think ultimately the brands that raised in the past 24 months, I think the position, and this again is just, this is across, you know, venture in general, is really the valuations they last raised on. And can you support those past valuations with the growth that you're now projecting? And so I think part of that is there's a way forward. It's ultimately like, how much of the business are you willing to give up though? Again, if you're raising things like, you know, additional financing rounds, be it bridge rounds or formal series rounds. And so I think for a lot of these brands, there's definitely a way forward. I don't want to make it seem like it's not, like it's like there's like blood in the streets. Like I actually think it's a pretty good environment, actually, I think, for M&A activity. I think we've kind of seen that over the past couple months. There's possible discounts behind those M&A transactions. But, you know, I think ultimately right now, the brands that are in the best positions are the ones that have actually created a niche in their market with their product themselves. And, you know, I think the brands that raised in the past couple months, but, you know, own the means of production or, you know, own patents on things or own certain you know, certain pieces of IP, if you will, behind their product, being the ones that are in the best position, You know, again, I think going back to like the drop shippers of the world, I think it's great business. I just don't think it's really like acquirable business. So I actually think it's a good time for M&A transactions for brands, again, albeit at, you know, a possible discount to their past valuations.
So a bit of a change in gear. Just talk us through again what you're doing now, aside from that, and really why you chose that direction. What was it that was so attractive to go in that direction for you?
Yeah, so I think, so what I do now is I work with brands and third-party logistics companies to basically rework their distribution strategies. So I work with a lot of food and beverage brands to basically align their distribution from the point of production down to their end consumers, whether that's in a retail store or, you know, through an e-commerce website. And so that sounds kind of nebulous, but really how that takes form is through basically warehousing and transportation. So, you know, moving trucks around, creating networks of warehouses, you know, cross-docked terminals. And this is kind of like the next iteration of kind of what we'd started at the warehouse, which was this idea of like managed supply chain for smaller brands. And so really what we've kind of gotten into is allowing brands to effectively run their own domestic supply chain as opposed to having to rely on, you know, distributors into retail or expensive third-party logistics options. So it's ultimately kind of putting the power back in the brand's hands to facilitate their own distribution, basically. And again, the way that takes form is through transportation and logistics. So I chose that direction just because I think it's probably the biggest problem, I think, not just in, you know, our industry, but I think, you know, really globally. I think the way that the current domestic and international supply chains are set up, you know, albeit efficient for what they need to be, are actually drastically inefficient compared to what they can be. And so again, here in the US, just the way that products move, you know, if you saw the many touch points that it takes to get a canned beverage from the point of production onto retail shelves, you'd understand why it gets so expensive. And it really doesn't have to be that way, I guess is the point. So that's ultimately what we're trying to do is drive efficiency and drive value in these supply chains. To give brands the power back to actually manage these things, but also just to drive costs down. And again, I always joke around about, you know, grocery distributors that, again, if you saw how many touch points there were and really where the costs come from, you'd see that it's not the cost of the product. And, you know, you always see on like Twitter and LinkedIn, you know, people talking about, you know, price increases for products and, you know, the poor founders like sitting there defending themselves as these price increases go up. And it's like, it's not always their fault. You know, it's not always just production costs. There's a lot of people that are touching their product along the way. And so we're ultimately trying to get that power back into their hands.
There's a bit of a mobster-esque feel to some of this grocery side where I understand this to be true in the US where there's certain elements of that supply chain you have no control over and it must be done in such a way. Like you'll be able to explain better than me, but my understanding is that it has to go to a certain warehouse and to be distributed by a certain company to hit certain shelves for certain stores. And you have limited visibility at best. Is it someone that I follow and have followed for a long time called Max Tuning? He created a brand called Sour Strips. He's a YouTuber. For anyone that doesn't know him, go check him out. And he's just like the kind of, or at least he plays the fool in terms of his entrepreneurial experience in these sorts of things and comes across these issues. And I think for a lot of founders, it's a problem, especially small business founders, where it's just default expected. And what I mean by that is you order a product from your manufacturer, you sort of don't think about that middle bit, whether it's going to your own 3PL, like you said, or whether it's going to your own warehouse or on shelves. It's sort of like, in my head, a bit foggy. It's sort of like it happens and it costs this much and you chuck it in your contribution margin spreadsheet. You don't think anything else of it. So if that's the default for a lot of small businesses, what's the difference? Maybe along the supply chain, we could do it in some kind of order.
Yeah. So it's really minimizing touches, right? So anytime anyone touches a product, whether it's a person or it goes into a warehouse, you know, anytime a different party touches it, it's going to cost more money. And so it's basically just limiting touches. So like you talk about, again, things like grocery warehouses, grocery distribution centers, they want to come and pick it up. They want to put it in their warehouse. They want the retailer to then buy it from them along with other products and then deliver it directly to that retailer. a lot of brands are finding that there's not really value in this distribution relationship. Like, they have these direct relationships with their buyers. They have a direct relationship with the retailer. They have enough volume to support themselves, basically, to actually deliver directly to stores or even deliver directly to the distributor. And so I think a lot of brands are finding that the value prop of, like, hey, it's ease of use, we'll just pick up and we'll handle this for you. It's like, oh, wow, you're a nice guy. Oh, and you'll help me out on the marketing side. Like, wow, this is a great relationship. It's like, there's not a ton of value there. It's really expensive on the physical distribution side to really rely on these partners in that way. And I think there's actually very limited resources on the marketing and merchandising side. So the value of a distributor, I think, is kind of disappearing in a way. And that's kind of like the next new frontier, I think, for a lot of this. So in the same way, I think that, again, in like 2017, 2018, there was a big pivot to e-commerce just because customer acquisition was lower, margin was higher, things are going well. There's been a lot of saturation there. And I think that, again, customer acquisition costs have gone up on the e-commerce side. And so, like, what's the best way to get your product in front of as many people as possible? It's, you know, to basically put it where they're shopping, which isn't, you know, on store shelves. And so it's like, now the question is not so much about customer acquisition, because, again, if they're seeing your product on shelves and it's merchandised well, you know, that's marketing in and of itself. And, you know, again, I'm not doing enough justice. There's marketing metrics that go behind that as well. But, you know, it's now how efficiently can I move those products into those stores, because I'm getting my product in front of people. People are seeing it. Now, how do I just lower that cost of actually getting my product there, or my cost to serve to actually get there? And so that's where traditionally, like, the marketing and operations folks, I don't want to say, like, haven't played nice to each other, but they've kind of operated in different worlds. And now I think they're actually kind of blending together in a way of, like, how do we actually balance these costs all around, not just with our e-commerce channels, but with all of our other channels as well. And so, there's definitely, to your point, a little bit of, like, a mobster-esque aspect to it. I think a lot of brands are doing their due diligence now, though. I mean, I'll tell you that since 2018, I think the bar, again, has significantly been raised on the operations side. And I think that the conversations being had now are significantly more high level relative to the stage that brands are at. I mean, I think a lot of brands that are in, like, the $5 to $10 million range are having conversations internally that maybe only would have happened if they hit $100 million and, you know, $1 billion, 5-10 years ago.
What are they talking about? What are some of the things that are happening in those conversations?
I think just, like, basically how they're distributing their product, where they want to distribute their product, how they want to open up, the quote unquote doors in retailers, I think are just becoming way more, prudent and critical. I think back, again, 4 or 5 years ago, it was like, oh, hey, we talked to Target. They want to launch us nationally. It's like, great, sign the dotted line. It's like, this is Target. This is great. You know, we're going to have purchase orders for $1 million. But, you know, now it's like, okay, so if I have a national launch in Target, you know, I'm a LA-based brand, never mind the middle of, Kansas, does anyone in, New York or, Florida know about my brand? It's like, possibly not. So I think now there's a little bit more of a prudence behind, maybe I just want to go after a local launch or a regional launch. Maybe I don't even want to go into a big box retailer. Maybe I want to start with a bunch of really small, footprint stores like delis, bodegas, convenience stores, or local retailers or regional retailers. So those are a lot of the conversations about, like, just the commercial aspect of how they want to kind of land and expand, if you will. And then I think on the physical distribution side, again, the value prop for a while was like, hey, we'll just, we'll come pick up product from you, or, we're UPS, we'll just ship your stuff everywhere. It's become a little bit more critical of, okay, so if this distributor's offered to pick up my product, can I deliver myself cheaper to them than if they picked it up? And yeah, maybe that, cost me a little bit more time. But I save a significant amount of money. Or hey, I used to ship everything with UPS, but maybe I want to use this regional, parcel provider in Southern California, like OnTrack, because, that's where most of my customer base is, and it's actually less expensive than UPS, and it gets there faster. So there's just a lot more knowledge, I think, in the industry. I think that brands have done a good job of, I think, kind of catching up to that. I think there's a lot to still be done. And I think it's incumbent upon us on the, services side to do our job. I think previously it was just like, hey, we'll just, we'll handle it for you. And it wasn't really a value add. It was kind of just a commodity. So I think, our side of the table, we need to now, continue to provide more solutions, basically, as brands are asking more of these questions.
Presumably it's a direct attack on the incumbents like DHL and like these roll up kind of warehouses that then distribute to supermarkets or grocery stores. So how do you think they're feeling? What conversations are they having internally to be like, how do we get around this? How do we maintain our kingdom?
I think in a lot of ways, those types of companies, like think like the DHLs, the Kuehne+Nagel, Geodis, even Flexport to a degree, and then now, Amazon with these like roll-up services where it is like this idea of end-to-end supply chain. I actually think they're fighting a bit of a different battle more on the enterprise side. Like these services have existed, right? Like this idea of, hey, we're going to manage your supply chain end-to-end. And so I think they're kind of swimming in more of the enterprise waters. I think that where, like, there's basically, I think, room for these components in the market, meaning like this modular system of like, yeah, maybe I don't run all of my supply chain through DHL. Maybe I have, again, like I have a factory sourcing partner, I have a factory QC partner, I have a freight forwarding partner. And so it's just different partners. So it's kind of modular. I think there's actually room in the market for both. And frankly, I don't think DHL really wants that kind of small business side of things. They'd rather continue to service that enterprise side. Whereas there's, again, tech companies and, tech/service companies that are like, no, actually, we want to go after SMB because we see there's more of an opportunity in this market. So I think that in a lot of ways, like there's actually room in the market for both. I think where it gets really interesting is when enterprise value starts to decrease with some of these larger companies, which I think was the idea that, again, Flexport was going after. I think Shopify was originally going after with their acquisition of Deliver, and then subsequent sale was like, how can we deliver scale basically like at this enterprise level to smaller brands, but then also roll up enterprise value for our bigger customers? That's a really tough, I think, line to walk, because the needs of an enterprise brand versus an SMB are significantly different. So I think that's where it gets tough. But I think that so long as DHL is swimming in their own pool and Amazon swims in their own pool, there's actually a lot of room in the market for these like SMB type solutions.
You seem like a good person to ask. Could you explain to me what, because I've obviously seen the Shopify Flexport and then the subsequent fallout. Some people are claiming that Jeff Bezos is behind it and should be some kind of immortalized statue in history for this move. Some people are saying it's nothing to do with Amazon. Like, can you just explain, like, what was Shopify's intention, do you think, going into it? What were they trying to achieve? And then why did they sell it? And then what is now happening since it's been sold? Like, where's it gone? Why is it gone there?
Yeah, I think originally Shopify kind of went down this path to effectively kind of compete with Amazon. I think the problem that they faced is that, and I think a lot of people kind of miss this, is that Amazon's able to do what Amazon does because they have product, like they act like a distributor, right? They buy product, they have it in their, facilities. I should say they don't actually buy, but my point is they have it in their own facilities, right? So they can control where the product is. And they also, like, it's all their own stuff, right? So these are their own warehouses. In a lot of cases, their own drivers running back and forth between facilities. There's a lot of like DSPs and contractors actually making the end deliveries. But the point is that they have the product in their facilities, and so they can move product around their network how they like that fits their network. Shopify tried to do that, but with more of a cloud-based approach, or what's called like a 4PL model, where they don't own the warehouses, and the warehouses are all kind of fragmented, and then inventory kind of sits in different spots and becomes an inventory control issue. So I think they were originally going on this path to compete with Amazon and say, hey, we can deliver everything in 2 days. Not realizing that like the consumer didn't really care about that, right? Like if the consumer wanted that, they would just go to Amazon anyway. They're not going to go on Shopify and say, oh, like I want my free 2-day shipping. Like I think in a lot of ways, the consumer was trained that if they went on Amazon, they could expect 3 to 5 days, which was kind of standard. So I think Shopify was kind of chasing this dream, which a lot of brands were, of like, you have to offer 2-day shipping to be competitive. And it's just a lie. And I don't want to say it's a lie from like a nefarious standpoint, but it was basically a figment, I think, of the industry's imagination that like you needed to have 2-day in order to scale properly. When in reality, it's like Amazon's just doing that. So like if my customer wanted to buy my product in 2 days, they're just going to go to Amazon because they've been trained to do that. So Shopify acquires Deliver for, I think, $2 billion a couple years ago. Didn't really own any warehouses. A lot of what they were again using it for was this idea of like setting up a network, though. I think the problem is that, like a lot of other companies, they didn't realize how difficult it is to manage a straight SaaS business with a like asset-based business, like a warehousing business. And I think, you know, Toby said it when they were, basically selling Deliver back to Flexport, was like, yeah, this is a bit of a side quest. And I think that Amazon actually started the opposite way, which was, you know, this was actually at the forefront. And then we kind of rolled tech up into it. So I think that was kind of the issue there. I think we'd love to imagine kind of this like romanticized view that like it actually was a real threat to Amazon. It just wasn't though. I mean, the infrastructure that Amazon has for what they do is pretty mind boggling. I actually don't think there was like a legitimate threat from Shopify to take on like significant market share from what Amazon was doing. Now, as far as, you know, Amazon's involvement in kind of that downfall, I actually think that kind of came after the fact. I think what you've seen now is actually a direct shot across the bow from Amazon with Flexport. So Flexport acquired Deliver, which was, you know, the logistics unit of Shopify, which included not only warehouses, but like trucking and transportation domestically. And so I think, you know, Flexport had this thing with like this end-to-end supply chain management platform, for small brands. And I think like a day later, Amazon had a PR release for Amazon supply chain. So I think that kind of indicated where I think the industry is kind of moving is this idea of like, hey, you know, A, we're going to look at end-to-end supply chain, but Amazon's also kind of planting their flag. The other real thing, if you want to really put your tinfoil hat on, is Amazon has so much money that they could potentially just make PR. They can even hire whole teams just to basically say, you know, give the impression that they're actually working on this just to kind of, you know, stall competition, when in reality, they have no intention at all of actually doing this. So that's the other like really kind of conspiratorial part is, are they just doing this to kind of stall competition? Do they actually have any intention of, you know, commercializing this? Like, I don't know. Crazier things have been done. But yeah, there's a lot of speculation, I think. But I think ultimately the issue is that Shopify was really trying to compete directly with Amazon, not realizing that they just weren't the same type of company.
Thank you. Much more understood now. I feel like I'm clued up. I appreciate that. What are they taking 3PLs, like independent 3PLs? It seems to be one is popping up every minute at the moment, all over the world. It seems to be a crazy rush to go and acquire some warehouse space, get some forklifts and put your 3PL hat on. So what's going on there? What's driving that, do you think? And do you agree? Is there an increase in 3PLs, independent 3PLs, decrease, stayed the same? Have I just noticed it more? Just give us a bit of an insight into what's going on there.
Yeah, I think there's like a bit more of like a bifurcation now. I think you have this idea of like the large, like, you know, big time 3PL. And it's funny, like the industry standard of like the big VC backed 3PL right now is like the ShipBob or the ShipMonk of the world. Like there's other big 3PLs out there that, you know, you've probably never heard of that, you know, operate, you know, 20, 30, 40 plus warehouses throughout the US, you know, and you can see the same thing in APAC, Oceania, Europe. I mean, it's kind of the same thing. And I think that, you know, right now there is a big push, I think, you know, definitely less so than there was 2-3 years ago, but there's still a big push, I think, for this idea of the independent 3PL. I also think there's actually a big push for brands to like self-fulfill again. I was kind of along this path of, yeah, you know, there's really no reason why you shouldn't be using a 3PL if you're above a certain like order threshold. But I think the problem is that in a lot of ways, these big VC-backed 3PLs have not actually lived up to basically their service level agreements. And so any value that is derived from their economies of scale goes out the window. You know, when you have hundreds of orders misshipped or, you know, just not shipped or whatever the issue is. So it's an interesting time right now. I think a lot of brands are thinking about things like self-fulfillment because they want to exercise more control. And they're saying, well, look, if I'm going to have this many issues, let it be under my own roof at least. So, you know, I think that the next kind of iteration of this whole thing is I think there will be a lot of these independent 3PLs. I just don't know if they're meant to be like venture backed or if they're kind of just meant to be lifestyle businesses, which is totally cool. I don't know to what degree they can deliver scale, especially again, if they have, you know, maybe a smaller footprint, you know, in not, you know, major metro markets or if they only have one location. So again, I think we'll see kind of how that turns out. I do think there's, again, still a place in the market for those types of 3PLs. I do just wonder, again, like, will we see as much venture back in that side of the industry as we did, again, like 2018 and 2019?
you are in the D2C space, if you have a brand that's selling online and you haven't at least had a demo with Sendlane, then one of two things is objectively true about you. You like setting money on fire, you like making your life more difficult. If neither of those things are true and you are an e-commerce brand and you are selling online, you do send emails, you do send SMS, you do have reviews, or you at least like to collect reviews, then there is no reason for you not to at least have had a demonstration with Sendlane. They are built for e-commerce. They are the most modern platform with the best features, in my opinion, at the lowest cost. I mean, I'm not really sure what would be holding you back. Please go and check them out. Show notes below, they have an event coming up. You can still get tickets, I believe, for that event in San Diego. A link to the Commerce Roundtable in the show notes below as well. Please do go and check out Sendlane if you haven't already. Back to the episode.
All right. So where do you see the biggest opportunities for the brands that you're serving at the moment in the current climate? What are you turning on for them?
Yeah, I think the biggest opportunity I see is actually in brick and mortar, and not, I think, in the way that like you would traditionally think about it, like people going to sort of pick up. It's basically become, so like parcel is probably the most, just kind of across the board, parcel is going to be the most expensive way to get product to a person or a store. So if I can facilitate movements of freight that on a unit basis is less expensive to stores, and then basically have my product in stores, then delivered to me. And again, not in the traditional sense of like, hey, I'm going to do this whole ship from store thing, but of like, hey, I want my groceries delivered from Walmart, or, you know, I want DoorDash to pick up, you know, my package from wherever. Like that, I think, is where the biggest opportunity is. And so it becomes this idea of like micro fulfillment, if you will, where like you walk into a Walmart or a Whole Foods now, like there's pseudo warehouses, right? There's like pick pack stations, there's like label printing machines. And so I think that's actually where like the next iteration of this opportunity is. Like, it's in brick and mortar, but not in the way that like is traditionally thought of, like, oh, someone's going to go in a store and grab my product off the shelves. They'll order online still. It'll just be picked up by someone or pick packed and shipped by someone at the store. So again, I think that's kind of the next area of opportunities in brick and mortar. And again, if someone goes in and buys the product off the shelf, totally fine too. But I think that that's where you get a little bit of both on the upside potential, being in brick and mortar. So I do think that there's definitely going to be a bigger push to brick and mortar. There's a whole conversation on customer acquisition costs there as well. But yeah, actually, I do see a bigger opportunity actually going back to brick and mortar. You know, which is, I guess, a little bit counterculture to this idea of like everything's going to go online.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really intelligent way to think about it. I know I've been in this game for a while and I've actually never thought of a supermarket or grocery store as a 3PL, but it makes so much sense. It's just a slightly different adaptation of that. I've never thought of that. Do you know, do they pass the cost? Does it matter to the merchant do they pass the cost on depending on where the product was bought? Is that factored in anyway? Is it bought in store or was it shipped? Is there any incremental cost for the merchant or not?
No, and I think it just becomes a matter of throughput. So I think that's where it's interesting as well, is that now you get this idea of variable cost out to the customer versus variable cost out to the merchant. So like if their product's in store, their product's in store, like the distributor bought, you know, they issued those POs a while back. So, you know, let's say the distributor or the retailer bought your product at a cost of $1 a unit. You know, whether they sell it for $2 on the shelf for someone to come pick it up, or it's, you know, $2.50 for someone to do like grocery store delivery, that cost is ultimately passed on to the consumer. And I think that what that ultimately does is it actually de-risks a lot of that process for the brand, and kind of puts the onus on the consumer to decide, okay, at what price point am I willing to buy this product? And, you know, then there comes the whole conversation of like convenience. You know, if I'm a busy person, you know, yeah, I'll pay 50 cents more for that can of soda, just to have it delivered to my door instead of actually having to go to the grocery store. So I think that whole idea is interesting for the brand as well, because it kind of de-risks that whole process. I also think it just simplifies the whole process too, of like, hey, it's going to go into a store. However, the store actually wants to get that to the customer, it's totally up to them. If it increases my throughput, great. If it decreases my throughput, you know, maybe I'll pull back a little bit, but I think in a lot of ways it actually, again, de-risks it and simplifies a lot for the brand.
What do you think happens to the marketing side then? because brands already got to market their own website. They're going to market probably pushing to Amazon in certain situations, potentially. Some don't, some do. And then they'll be marketing on Amazon, Google. And now you've got to start marketing to Walmart, but not in the traditional sense that go in store, which I know is quite an important metric for, you know, products bought off shelf. I think that's quite high up on their reporting, I guess. And then, but you also now got the conflict of actually, no, we're a food and bev or a beverage. We're going to really attack that, strategy that you just laid out and try and get people to order this, that like now available to ship to your home from Walmart, you know, or something like that. Like, how do you see that playing out? Do you think it's just another thing to add to the marketing pile?
I do. And I think that, you know, basically marketing, I think, as a function within kind of the world of CPG, especially the e-commerce side, was more a function of, you know, again, basically just customer acquisition by way of, you know, Facebook ads, retargeting, you know, how the site looked, conversion on that side. So I'm walking a little bit out of my depth as far as what the like role, I think, of the marketer is going forward. That being said, I think that if you boil down really any role within the consumer goods business, it's basically how do I get my product in front of as many people as possible to buy at the price point that I want them to buy at. And so I think the role of the marketer ultimately then becomes, again, how do I get this product in front of people? And so I think historically that was through, again, things like Facebook or social media ads. Maybe that still remains the same. It would be tough to say, but I think that the role of the marketer in specifically retail is, okay, great, now I have all these eyes on my product, but there's also 50,000 other products in the store. How do I draw attention to my product? That's not just from like a label. That might be through things like out-of-home advertising, things like continued use of Facebook ads, so that when someone does go to the store, they recognize your brand already and they might subconsciously do this, but like, okay, I saw this on Facebook. I saw this in an out of home advertisement. Now I'm in the store and I see the product here. Oh, okay, yeah, I recognize that product. So I think it's just, again, like operations, like finance, you know, marketing, I think, is just going to iterate into this next phase. And I think, you know, again, like any other part of the industry, the ones that evolve are the ones that are going to do well. I think it's again, less so in a traditional sense of what we've known to be of CPG marketing, but I actually think that marketing is, you know, an extremely important aspect of this. It's just a matter of what it actually looks like. And, you know, I don't envy the marketer in this sense, because again, I think that with retail, it's very tough. I think it'll be interesting over the next couple of years to see how those iterations come about. I think we're seeing a lot of creative stuff out there as far as like that goes. I mean, there's a company called Agile Media, you know, where they'll basically, and I'm sorry, I'm not doing this justice at all, where it's basically like, you know, advertising on the side of trucks that then, you know, retargets, you know, customers and audiences that way. So there's just way more creative ways to kind of go about this. That's just one example. But you know, I think that's what's interesting to me, is I think it's evolving, and the solutions that are out there are also evolving. But yeah, now I think marketing is going to be tantamount to the success of these brands. It's just a matter of how.
100%. With that truck thing, I love that they're starting to incorporate old ad world with, I believe that they can geolocate devices that were within the vicinity of and likely to have seen that ad. And you can buy that data and run ads to it in other formats. I think that's sick. I think that only really happens on programmatic, which is a bit of shit, but it can happen anyway. Revolutions seems to be revolutions in this. Retail, high street, D2C, online, retail, high street, D2C, online. Seems to have these sort of, the retail side of things seems to just go down a bit and come back and down a bit and come back. What's driving that, do you think? Do you agree, first and foremost? I remember a time where everyone was like, oh, high street's dead. No one going to retail. And now it sounds like there's a resurgence in that. So is that all driven just by cost of acquiring a customer, do you think? What do you think is the main driving forces behind that?
I think it's ultimately consumer behavior. I think consumer behavior is ultimately going to dictate, you know, what, you know, that's like the leading indicator, which is tough because it's like, how do you, you know, it's very tough to just track consumer behavior that way. So it becomes like a lagging indicator, if you will. where it's like, hey, I'm making decisions based on, you know, old data that again is a lagging indicator. So yeah, maybe my retail sales are down. So I'm going to focus more on e-commerce. I do think it's cyclical though. I also think it's a function of geography. I think it's a function of the consumer themselves. I think it's a function of the product. Like there's probably infinite variables that go into it. But, I think as far as like why it is cyclical, I think it's just ultimately a function of consumer behavior. And so, you know, I think that as far as, you know, things like clothing goes, I think a lot of people, you know, like personally for me, like I actually hate shopping in store for clothing. My girlfriend will not shop online for clothing because she wants to make sure things fit. She doesn't want to have to send things back. So like, I ultimately think again, like it depends a lot on what the different products are, but I think what drives kind of that cyclical nature, at least that perceived cyclical nature, is really consumer behavior. And I think consumer behavior can really be dictated by things like social media trends, you know, convenience, you know, of location of product. You know, there's really myriad reasons for it. I think what that ultimately tells the brand though is to basically be agile, and be able to kind of like pivot as needed. So I think that anyone that says like, hey, I'm only going to focus on brick and mortar, I'm only going to focus on e-commerce, or I'm only going to focus on Amazon, or potentially leaving money on the table. And the reason I say that is because, again, like to the degree that you can manage it, you know, I don't want to be in front of as many customers as possible, you know, at least through my sales channels. And so I think that to have a presence in each of those fields, and it's tough, right? Because it's not like it's really tough to just focus on one of those, never mind three or four of those. But I think it's warranted now. And again, I think as the bar continues to get raised and, you know, there's this omnichannel presence, you know, there's that need to kind of be seen there. And there's always maybe the corner case with like, you know, I've heard like the Facebook moms group that, you know, sells baby clothing and they only get their orders through the Facebook group and they do, you know, $10 million a year. And it's just like a mom and like her sourcing partner in China. So there's always going to be those corner cases, where that's, it's just, you know, it's not the rule basically, but I think across the board to have an omnichannel presence to then be less, you know, prone to the issues of, you know, changing consumer behaviors is going to be, you know, of the utmost importance.
And it sounds like that's becoming more and more accessible by some of the work that you're doing for some of the smaller brands or the lower revenue brands, which is a super interesting space to be playing in. One final question for you then for a very quick lightning round is, what's the next step, the big step change in this industry? We've had things like drone delivery being flirted and we've seen the videos of people tipping over like Uber and Deliveroo robots in the streets of New York and things like that. Like, what do you think is genuinely a possibility on the kind of midterm horizon?
Yeah, it was funny. I was walking through a Walmart last week and I saw like the ship from store operation going on, and or not the ship from store, but like the, you know, curbside pickup, curbside delivery operation. And I kind of had this thought of like, do stores ultimately become mostly warehouses? And I'm sure Walmart has this data of like, you know, how many people buy in store, how much product is bought in store versus, you know, bought for curbside delivery. And it kind of made me think of like a world where no one is actually going out and shopping for themselves, but stuff is either delivered to their door by a UPS or a FedEx, or by a gig economy worker that is, you know, again, picking products up from stores. So to me, I think the next like big thing is going to be just that of like, do we end up shopping anymore for ourselves, or does like shopping as a service become a thing? And then you can kind of go down the rabbit hole of like, is it just your groceries, or maybe now it's your dry cleaning, you know, stuff like that. So like, I just think there's that idea of like shopping as a service, I think will, in my opinion, is kind of the next like iteration of this. You know, I'm not sure when that kind of happens, but, you know, I think people really want convenience. I think, you know, you've seen all like the tweets of like the service charges for DoorDash and Uber Eats, but, you know, here we all go ordering that stuff. So like there is a value to convenience. And I just, for me, at least, I think the next iteration is this idea of like, again, shopping as a service where, you know, stores are operating more like warehouses, and consumers are, you know, again, basically just used to having stuff dropped off their door.
Yeah, I think we're not far off that, really. Not in the UK, at least. All right, a couple of lightning fire questions for you. Quick fire questions, I should say. One word, one sentence, somewhere around that mark would be great. What was the last thing you purchased for a D2C brand?
Ooh, net new, it was Pizzazz Energy Spray, which was a little bit of a while ago, but most recently it was Huron Body Wash. So,
of course it was. Of course it was. I hope Matt's listening. What brand gilet does your brother wear, and do you have one too?
Ooh. What brand?
Gilet. So the finance bros. You know, like a coat with no sleeves in London.
Oh, yes, yes. Gilets. Oh, okay. Yeah. His company is on Marmot. That's what they wear. I go for more of the traditional Patagonia look.
You can't beat your Patagonia. You can't beat your Patagonia.
I know. I gotta move on to like Arc'teryx or something like that.
All the finance guys will get that. If you were to be able to sit down with someone from history for a dinner, just to pick their brain, have a conversation with them, who would you choose?
Probably Dale Carnegie.
I'm not sure who that is. I'm not sure why. Who is that?
He is. He was like the captive industry of like the turn of the century here in the U.S. Like big steel person. So just very very interesting takes on business and you know, just like vertical integration, horizontal integration as a whole. So pretty big business magnate.
It sounds like it. Yeah, unbelievable. Okay, man. Well, where can people get at you if they want to speak to you? And can you just give a concise kind of overview of the services that you offer to maybe some of the listeners?
Yeah, definitely. I'm on Twitter, just Fraser Kinsley. Also on LinkedIn. Services we offer, obviously on the investment side, seed and early stage, so anything in the food and beverage world, health and wellness, you know, apparel. And then on the services side for supply chain, companies called Warp. The website is wearewarp.com. And if you're a food and beverage brand, anywhere from just starting out to $100 million brand, we can help you on your distribution and freight consolidation that way. So anywhere you want to find me, I'm pretty accessible. My DMs are always open. But yeah, if you want to check out our sites, kinsleypartners.com. On the investment side, on the services side, it's wearewarp.com.
That was Fraser on the Ecom Gold Podcast. Thank you very much for tuning in to another episode with me and a wonderful guest. Next week, we'll be back with another great guest. So do tune in and like, share if you see us on social media. Thank you for listening. As always, this show is brought to you by Sendlane and Rewind. Links below. Please do check them out. Helps the show and their fantastic solutions are handpicked because I know you'll love them. Also, why not check out Fraser's brand while you're there? All right. See you next week.